I discovered that some of my patients, actually about 15% of my patients, reported at the end of the session that they had an experience that they believed was involved actual contact with the deceased person they were grieving. When this happened, at the time, the first time the patient reported this to me, I had no idea what they were talking about. These people who were having these after-death communications were oftentimes leaving the office feeling joyous and euphoric even at times. So I went back and looked at my notes to see if I might see something that was causing, you know, this experience to occur. And I saw it.
So that was Dr. Alan Botkin. He is a psychiatrist. No, he's a psychologist. Either way, he was dealing with folks who had post-traumatic stress and had some grief that they were dealing with under traumatic conditions. And he was using a new technique where they mimic rapid eye movement. And while he was doing that, people started having what they considered almost like near-death experiences, or experiences where people who had been dead, deceased, they were seeing them in vision types of things, I guess. And he didn't plan on that. I mean, this guy's a psychologist, and he was, you know, treating people who had some issues. And then all of a sudden this stuff started to happen. And he's like, whoa, you know, what's going on here? So he wrote a book about it called Induced After-Death Communication. And if you want to read more about it, check that out. The reason why I had him open up the show, or use that little clip to open up the show, is that today's guest is Rachel Greenberg. And I had her on because she's a grief specialist, maybe a counselor, I think, and she helps people deal with grief. And I thought it would be an interesting topic to have on the show. You know, we talk a lot about life and death, and grief is something that we're all going to have to face someday. And the show turned out to be more along the lines of this induced after-death communication, because she had experienced this. I'll let her tell her story, and you'll hear it coming up here. But to kind of give you an idea, she had lost a loved one, and she was doing this traumatic stress thing where you do the REM, and all of a sudden she sees her late husband. And she's a skeptic. She was a staunch atheist. She was not in it to find some sort of mystical experience, and the mystical experience found her. So it's really, really fascinating stuff, and I think you'll enjoy the show. So thanks again for tuning in, and take a listen.
You're listening to the Wait, What If podcast.
Welcome to the Wait, What If podcast. Tonight we have Rachel Greenberg. Do you go by your middle name too? Is it the?
No, I go by Rachel Greenberg.
Okay. And I'm actually not sure how I found you, Rachel. I think it was just maybe talking on Twitter or something like that.
I think so, yes.
That's funny. It's. I'm getting a lot more people that way, which is kind of fun. When I first started my show, you know, it took a lot of work to book people, and because I'm a one-man show, so everything I do, all the production and everything, I have to do on my own. And since my footprint on Twitter is growing, I'm starting to get more and more you know, people from like LA, you know, you're over in LA.
Oh, correct? Interesting. Yeah. Oh, right. No, I'm excited. I've been listening to some of your podcast. I'm really impressed. I'm looking forward to this.
Well, thank you very much. Rachel has a interesting story. I guess what I'll do, because it's a personal story, and I don't, you know, I'll let you talk about what you want to talk about. I guess we'll just start it off then with you doing a brief introduction, and then I guess telling us a little bit about your story.
Okay, great. Well, my name is Rachel Greenberg, and I live in Los Angeles, California, in Hermosa Beach, actually. And I would like to talk about, you know, what happened with my late husband. In March of 2013, it started out like any other day. I left my house to do errands like I'd done so many Saturdays before that. And while I was away, my husband Glenn suffered a massive brain hemorrhage. We never spoke again. When I arrived home on that terrible day, he was clearly in trouble. He looked at me, almost looking right through me. Little did I know that that would be the last moment that our eyes would meet.
There was nothing that precluded this.
No, like that nothing, okay. Nothing. He was healthy. I mean, he did have high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. But he had gone surfing that morning, so yeah. Had worked the night before. I mean, no signs, although in hindsight, he did talk about an untimely passing.
Really?
On more than one occasion, yes. Although he was not sick, mm-hmm. nor was he depressed. He was happy-go-lucky, the most cup runneth over, half cup half full person you could meet. So this was out of the blue, although he had been working quite a bit,
more
than he should have been. Actually, two jobs at the time. His truck, the transmission blew, and so he was just such a responsible man and wanted to take care of everyone else. He decided to take on a second job, but he was a strong man. That was nothing unusual for him. So, you know, when I was back at home, clearly something was wrong. He tried to talk to me, and it all came out gobbledygook. I don't know what he was trying to tell me, and then he lost consciousness. You know, I quickly sprang into action. I had just had taken actually a first aid CPR course at work a few months prior, and I remember the instructor telling us, you know, if you're ever in this situation where you have to administer CPR or try to save someone, that you will find yourself being calm. Mm-hmm. And I was. Before I knew it, I had 911 on the phone with one hand on my cell phone and the other opening his airwaves. He started breathing again, but he was going in and out of consciousness, and he was rushed to UCLA, Ronald Reagan Medical Center, where I was immediately told there's no hope. Oh, wow. The head physician said he's got a brain bleed, as bad as they come. And we'll try and operate, but he's already in a coma. Say your goodbyes. Mm. But Glenn survived the brain surgery. I wasn't surprised because he was a strong man. There was no swelling, no seizures. His vitals were stable, but he wasn't waking up from the coma. And after 4 days sitting vigil in the ICU, more bad news. We were told that the brain bleed caused 80 to 90% brain damage in his brain stem. And I believe you're in the medical profession, so you know that the brain stem controls your primal bodily functions like breathing. Mm-hmm. So there was no coming back from this. I called his family in New York, gave them the terrible news that we'd keep him on life support until they could come out and say goodbye, and then we'd let him go.
Wow.
So yeah, it was awful. The only silver lining to it is that while I was waiting for his family to come out, I found out that Glenn was a donor.
Right.
That he had signed up at the DMV just a few months before, and actually then all the memories came right back. I remembered the exact day. He had come home. He was all proud of himself. He goes, "I've signed up to be a donor. I met a woman in line who had received a kidney 10 years ago, and she went on to thinking she was going to die to getting married and starting a family of her own." So this inspired him that he signed up to be a donor, but little did we know, just 4 or 5 months later, he would be that donor. So that was the silver lining, but that was pretty much the only one. It was rough. You know, I the movies, the books, the stories, all about death and widowhood. It's all a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
You know, and grief for that matter. And I quickly found that out. You know, it's funny. It's right after Glenn died, I thought that something really wonderful would happen to make up for the bad. But I shortly, you know, I found out that life doesn't work that way. Instead, it just keeps moving forward. And I'll just quickly go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and that life has a way of doing that. You know, it thrusts you into situations that you don't plan for. You know, it just, you know, how do you plan for that? You can't. And I'm sure that you, I mean, even when you went out, you said you went out to run some errands.
Yes, I was. I went out to get groceries.
Yeah, and you had no idea that within a few days, I mean, would be the last time you see him. And that's, I mean, I think that's an important thing for people to understand is that, you know, there is no guarantee, and it sounds cliche, but there isn't. There's no guarantee that there's a tomorrow, and the little things that wind you up and seem to consume your days are just petty, you know, when it comes to the big things. Because when you think of death, and when I think of it, and I think it's natural for anyone to think of this, it's something that's far away, you know, that we may, you know, we will. I was about to say we may face it. We will face it. Everyone will face it. But it's something that we don't have to think about right now. Instead, I'll worry about, you know, the dent in my car or a hole in the wall or something like that. And your story really, really hammers home that you know, you really shouldn't do that because it could come at any time.
It's so true. And then at the same time, you know, we can't live our lives waiting for death because we have to be able to enjoy the time that we have here. So it's like finding that balance.
Yeah.
You know, but it's funny you say that, what you were talking about, because I mean, because Glenn did talk about his untimely passing on more than one occasion. So I always kind of had it in the back of my mind, even though this may seem ridiculous, that I was a hardcore atheist. So how could a hardcore atheist also kind of like follow the intuition path? I remember Glenn and I had only been dating about 6 months, and we got in his car to go somewhere, and the Leon Russell song, A Song for You, came on the radio, and there's some lyrics about something about like when my life is over, and you know, you'll remember when we were together, and I'll sing this song for you. And when that was on the radio, Glenn said, well, you know, you're going to really miss me when I'm gone. But he also wasn't saying that to be a jerk or to be a martyr. It was almost as if he knew. And I remember when that happened, I got like this electrical, like pulsing zing in my heart area. And I just said, oh, that's ridiculous, Glenn. But inside of me, I kind of like thought it's going to happen. And then it happened another time when we were at the eye doctor like 2 or 3 years later. And, you know, we were bickering about something stupid as couples do, like a parking meter or something like that. And we were in the reception area and the receptionist looked at me and she said, you know, I wish I could have those days back bickering with my husband who passed away 6 months ago. And that I got that same zing in my heart, like, oh my goodness, this is going to happen to Glenn. And of course I dismissed it and, you know, I went on with my life and yada, yada, yada. And he did too. But I never forgot about those things, you know, ever.
Do you think there's something to that? Or do you think it's a coincidence? I mean, you said you're an atheist, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's no, I guess it puts you in the category of a skeptic, but you know,
well, yes. I mean, I'm not an atheist anymore. I mean, I'll tell you that I was a hardcore atheist. I mean, I was one of the obnoxious types. I mean, I'm not kidding that I think 2 or 3 nights before Glenn's brain bleed, we were having one of our many late night conversations in bed. And I think we had just turned the news off and there was a story about someone who had passed away and the family was talking about how they had comfort that the person was in heaven. I remember just being obnoxious and just saying to Glenn, oh, they're delusional. When you die, the light goes out. It's over. The worms crawl in and out. Mm-hmm. But a week later, I was a widow. So it was easy to be an atheist when Glenn was alive.
Right.
But once he passed away, it wasn't so easy to be in that position anymore. So I basically have spent the last 4 years in deep study to find out what happens after we die. Do we live on, or does it end forever?
In what ways? What ways have you studied?
Well, believe it or not, the first thing I did was to watch the TED Talk of the father of new atheism himself, Richard Dawkins.
Okay.
I was all excited. I was ready for white papers, peer reviews, all the facts. I mean, I thought science had it all tied up in a bow. And I was disappointed, because all he did was make fun of dogmatic religion. And so, therefore, his hypothesis was, well, a dogmatic religion isn't true. It's like believing in Santa Claus. Therefore, there's no afterlife.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find that with that is one of the atheists, when they start attacking, these really, really religious people, they don't realize that their form of atheism is almost a form of religion, because they believe
yes.
in it, and it's like,
it
takes away any of the thought process.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then I started researching consciousness, and I thought, okay, well, maybe forget Richard Dawkins, but science really has it tied up. And I found out, no, they don't. That science really doesn't know where consciousness comes from. I mean, they say, mind equals brain, we're a biological robot, life has no meaning, but yet, what is love? What are feelings? I was reading something the other day by I can't remember his name, but the physicist who invented the string theory. He doesn't even know where consciousness comes from, but yet calls it the great mystery. But yet, if science is calling it something the great mystery, isn't that all woo-woo and metaphysics? I mean, science isn't supposed to say things are a great mystery.
Right.
So then I started reading, like, Pim van Lommel, the cardiologist in the Netherlands, who wrote the book Consciousness Beyond Life, about near-death experiences. And then Dr. Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia, who's studying near-death experience, built on the research of Raymond Moody, Dr. Penny Satori, who used to be an emergency room nurse and then became a PhD and an NDE expert, Anthony Peake, the writer, just so many, and Dr. Samparnia, actually, who's an NDE expert and a professor at Cornell. So then having mystical experiences myself since before Glenn died and since he's died, I'm convinced that consciousness survives bodily death. I don't know what that means exactly, but it seems like the pendulum for me is swinging that way.
I have a thought about it. So when we break down the mechanics of our thoughts and our experiences, which only have meaning due to the function of our brain, okay? So our brain is this, it's a gooey, it's, we always see on TV or even in museums, like a brain almost looks like an organ that you can just pick up and walk around with, but it isn't. It's got the consistency. This is because I'm in medicine, I've
right, actually
got
right,
to
sure, sure.
hold a brain before, but it's got the consistency of jello, of a soft jello. So it's this goo, it really is this goo that's in our head. And if you break it down to its fundamental elements, that's exactly what it is. It's just atoms, Our brain is made up of atoms, and those atoms move back and forth through a membrane, and it creates action potentials. All right, so I'm getting too
no,
mechanical
I'm following
here.
You.
But basically what it does is it's a mechanical process that causes thoughts and causes memories and causes what we think are feelings and stuff. But when you break it down below that, because atoms aren't the basic forms of, of matter, it goes, I mean, I guess technically they are, but we also have subatomic particles. And when we get to the subatomic particle area, it's you're basically taking an inanimate object, which is an atom. You're giving that atom the power to create feeling and to create emotion and to create memories and consciousness. And then you're breaking that inanimate object down to this weird sort of mystical, no one really knows what subatomic particles are. You know, they're in existence, they snap out of existence. There's really no way to describe them physically. And when you get down to that level, you have to say, okay, if these particles aren't acting like the physical world, there has to be something there, whether it's, I don't know, a mode of transmission of thought and emotion. I don't know. But I think when you take something that is physical and it has this ability to do things that are almost metaphysical, and then when you look at it, there's a metaphysical property to it, it has to mean something more than we know.
Right. That makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I think sometimes the brain, I know this is such a cliche and it's been said so many times. It's like, you know, the television set and the spirit or the soul or whatever you want to call it is the television program, or the brain is the computer and what runs it is the software program.
Mm-hmm.
But yet science doesn't seem to be able to connect the two together.
Right.
I don't know. And I've just had too many experiences since Glenn has died that have convinced me that I think the consciousness, our consciousness does survive bodily death, but I don't know exactly what that means.
Right. And what do you have, kind of like your own hypothesis based on your research that is kind of your idea of what happens?
Well, I'm not quite sure, except for the fact, not to keep repeating myself, but that I do think we live on. You know, if you read the accounts of near-death experiencers, you find such a common thread over and over and over, regardless of what country of origin you're from or what your life experiences were. They just seem to be the same over and over, and not like hallucinatory, not like drug-induced, mm-hmm. or more like, and they say that it's more real than life itself. So that's something for me. I'm not quite sure. But then when I think about, like, you know, ancient man, or, you know, excuse the crude term, like caveman,
mm-hmm.
it makes me think, like, well, I don't know that, you know, why would a soul or whatever it is want to go into a body of like a caveman and have like a short, horrible life where you're just looking for food? And then what happened before that? I mean, let's say if humans were only on the earth for a million years, or even if a billion, if we live forever and it's infinity, then what was before that? So yeah. Stuff like that makes me doubt. But yet there's just too many things that have happened to me since Glenn died. I mean, even like, I have to tell you, the biggest thing was that I searched out how I could have a connection with Glenn. And I found this doctor in Chicago, Dr. Alan Botkin. And he used to work with Vietnam vets for many, many years. He worked in a Vietnam vet hospital in outside of Chicago, where they were severely troubled. I mean, many of them couldn't even get through it, wouldn't have a sleepful night. So he was treating them and found that, like, the regular treatments of talk therapy just wasn't working and actually making them suffer more. So he knew about this treatment called EMDR, which was invented by a Dr. Shapiro, which is basically rapid eye movement while you're awake.
I've heard about that. I don't know much about it, but I have heard about it.
Well, he started doing it with his patients, and mm-hmm. it was helping them. And one day he kind of decided to perfect it a little. I mean, I think the way it works is, well, I mean, I've had it done, so I can tell you, but you move your eyes back and forth. It's basically creating REM sleep, but when you're awake.
Mm-hmm.
And what was happening is that he kind of perfected this treatment So he was treating this one Vietnam vet who was severe depression, anxiety, PTSD, you name it, just haunted by what had happened in Vietnam. And so he was doing the treatment, and he decided to change it a little that day. And basically what you do is you move your eyes back and forth for like 20 or 30 movements, and then you close your eyes. And then you open your eyes and you do it again, and there's a pause between. Well, during the pause, he said that the patient seemed like almost blissful. And the doctor wasn't sure what was happening, and the patient opened his eyes, and the doctor asked him, and the patient said, well, I actually saw this young girl when he was in Vietnam. There was this child that he had kind of adopted, and she had kind of come to the camp where he and the other Marines were, and he had kind of taken her under her wing and taken care of her, and he was going to adopt her and bring her back, and he had already talked to his wife, and they were going to adopt her and have this child. Well, anyway, she was killed in a terrible death, and he witnessed it. It was awful, and he was haunted and haunted. And so he told this doctor that she came to him, but as a grown woman, and told him to move forward with his life, and that she was at peace, and that she was happy, and that they would be together again, and she loved him. And, you know, this Dr. Botkin didn't really know what to do. And he, you know, told the orderlies that night, you know, you better keep a real eye on this patient, because he thought, you know, he's really cracked. Mm-hmm. So he went to, you know, he had the patient come see him again the next day. And the patient had the first full night's sleep ever since the Vietnam War.
Wow.
And then he did that treatment, and it happened again and again and again and again and again, where the patient's not only were getting healed from their PTSD and their traumatic grief, but they were actually having what he coined as an instant after-death communication. Well, I mean, skeptical me, very, very, very skeptical of this. Mm-hmm. But in my search, I wanted to go see this Dr. Botkin. And was lucky enough that I found someone that had trained under him who had a practice in Los Angeles. There were only about 20 or 30 people in the world who have actually been trained under this doctor. And so I went to see him as a huge skeptic, as I still am in many ways. And I had an experience of a lifetime. Hmm. I've never done drugs, and I just listened to your episode about DMT and ayahuasca.
Right.
I had that experience without drugs.
Yeah, and I've heard that happening. I've heard of people experiencing that. There was a guy, I can't remember which episode it was. It was last year. I had a guy who was heavy into meditation, and actually he went to train with Shaolin monks in China. Or are they in Tibet? I think wherever they are, he was out there doing all sorts of crazy stuff with them. And he had mentioned that he had experienced DMT and ayahuasca, but he also learned breathing techniques that could take him into the same state.
Mm.
And he saw ayahuasca as kind of like a cheat, like, okay, you know, you figured out a backdoor entry to this process that you can actually do on your own with meditation and thinking, and or not thinking, breathing, and you know, I guess getting into a deep state. But no, it makes sense, and I wouldn't be surprised if the experience you had was very similar, if not the same experience that someone would have on DMT.
I mean, I've never done drugs, so I don't know, but all I can tell you, Kevin, is that I saw Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
It was like watching a movie. I saw Glenn as a child. I saw him with his family. I saw them at the park. I saw them going to the beach. I saw his wedding and our funeral happening at the same time. When I saw myself on the shores of Long Island scattering his ashes, and he came out of the water and he said, come to me. And I dove in the water, and my feet turned into a big fin. It was more real than the life I know now.
That's amazing.
And all I did was move my eyes back and forth.
Now
that was it.
So you did this process, and then you sort of went into this state, or could you see it like as if your eyes were closed and you're watching it?
Yeah, well, it's you know, he has like this wand thing, or it's like a baton, or sometimes with his fingers, and it's very primitive. It's just moving your eyes back and forth about 20 or 30 times, and then he would tell me to close my eyes. And the doctor said nothing. I mean, zero. And I initially went there because I did have PTSD after Glenn died. I mean, administering CPR, being rushed to the hospital, then taking him off life support. I just kept reliving it over and over and over. So the very first time it happened, he did tell me, though, while I was moving my eyes back and forth, he said, think about what happened when you came home on that Saturday and you found Glenn. And he said, it may get worse before it gets better. And I was filled with emotion and I started to cry. And I saw myself, you know, walk into the house, walk into the bedroom, and I saw Glenn in duress. But this sounds crazy, but within a millisecond, I saw his body pop out of the top of his head, and he jumped into the corner of the room. And he was jumping up and down, saying, I'm over here, I'm over here, I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive. I'm not that thing laying on the bed. And I was thinking to myself, what the heck?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I opened my eyes and we did like 20 more eye movements. And he said, okay, now go to the hospital and, you know, see yourself and see Glenn in the hospital. And then I closed my eyes and I could only see Glenn in the respirator because he was incubated the entire time. I mean, he was never conscious in the hospital, but all I could see was Glenn sitting up at the edge of his bed, talking to me and telling his sisters and I and his son about what happened and how he was all okay. But I knew that never happened.
Yeah.
And now for the life of me, I cannot picture Glenn with the respirator on him. I can't. It's really strange. And then so many other things.
Well,
so many.
And did you have, and I remember you had mentioned that sacred geometry had entered this at some point.
Well, this stuff all started happening after I was having these treatments done.
Okay.
I started having these mystical experiences spontaneously. And I'm a skeptic. So this was very strange for me. One night with the sacred geometry, which I didn't know what it was at the time, mm-hmm. I was, you know, laying in bed, getting ready to go to sleep and just close my eyes. And I was not asleep. And all of a sudden I saw like this bright spark. And then I saw another one and another one and another one and another one. And they were forming like perfect circumference between each of them. And then I saw sparks in between them and in between them. And then there was this beautiful pattern. And I just thought again, what the heck? And I opened my eyes and I got up and I went into the kitchen and got a glass of water. And so I started searching on Google Images I started describing, you know, how you can describe on Google Images what you're looking for. And so I found it. And it was called sacred geometry.
Yeah, so you didn't even know what sacred geometry was.
I had absolutely no idea what it was.
I don't quite know what it is. I know I've looked it up and I've read and I've watched some things about it. I couldn't describe it to someone, but I know that they are images and shapes and patterns that are supposed to represent perfection and are supposed to repeat themselves throughout, you know, our entire world, whether it be the ratio of your arm to your, you know, I don't know exactly what it is, but I know there's
exactly
all these ratios.
To your arm, to your, exactly. And even insects and flowers. Mm-hmm. There's a guy, Randall Carlson,
yeah.
who, if you've heard of him, he does talks a lot about sacred geometry.
He does.
He's done a lot of research.
Geocosmic Rex is his website. He's fantastic. He also does a lot of geology and things like that. But yeah, he does.
Yes.
He does a lot of really interesting talks on sacred geometry, and I forgot that was one of my sources.
Yeah.
So do you think, and then when you hear people who tap into this, well, I guess I have two things. One would be we try to, and we can only imagine what happens to us based on the reality that we live in. We have no way to perceive something beyond our universe and the physics of our universe. 'Cause all we know is here, and all we ever know while we're in our physical being is here. So there's no way to come up with anything else. And so to us, death of the physical body, we can't quite comprehend it. We say it's either over, but if it goes somewhere, where does it go? And I think we're approaching that the wrong way, because in our world, you go somewhere. But if you think about it more of transitioning a dimension, and that might sound cheesy, you know, oh, we're traveling through dimensions. But if you're going from this dimension to a higher dimension, there is no way for us to describe where you go. It's just there. There's this great story about the Flatlanders, and I've brought this up a few times on the podcast. So the Flatlanders are a group of people who live in a two-dimensional plane, and they look out on the horizon and they see these flashes of color, and they don't know what they are. And the best scientists in the Flatland come and they try to figure out what it is, and they're looking for patterns, but all they see is just flashes of different colors on the horizon. Well, it turns out what it is, they're on a flat sheet of paper and they're hanging over a pool table. And so when you put it into the three dimensions, you say, oh, naturally, it's a pool table. But there's no way for them to perceive that, because they can only see points of light or lines, right? And
yes.
And you put that in our world, and we say, okay, we see sacred geometry, or we have similar things that happen to us, or people that take ayahuasca and see these shapes and experience almost very, very similar things you experience. I'm thinking you're peeking, somehow you've tuned your brain to maybe peek behind the curtain and see, you know, what's next or what the next.
Well, I don't know, but I've had many more experiences, and they all, I mean, there was some intuition before, which I've shared with you, but the majority of these experiences have been after the EMDR, the IADC treatments. So, mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes when I would go for the treatments, and I still go, I mean, I see this doctor now about once a month. I look to him now as my teacher, my mentor.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been times when, like, we'll do the eye movements. And, of course, we don't do that every time I see him. But sometimes when we do, and I'll close my eyes and I'll, like, start telling him things that are in the other room. And I don't know where that's coming from. So for a while, I stopped going to see him because it freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah.
And, like, knowing things that would happen before they did. And I actually have to tell you, a few days ago, I was listening to one of your podcasts, and I can't remember which one it was, but I started to kind of daydream, and I thought about Glenn and his organ donations. About 30 seconds after that, you asked the person, or the person that was interviewing you, I can't remember who asked what, but one of you brought up organ donation and someone who had a heart transplant that started to get, they changed their sexual orientation after the heart transplant. That kind of jarred me, because I was thinking about organ donation just for no reason, and the podcast had absolutely nothing to do with it. But then you brought it up about 30 seconds after I was thinking it.
Wow.
And I mean, like, I would go out for a hike and I would say, okay, Glenn, I'm still a skeptic. If you really live on, then I want to see an eagle. And I know they're not in Southern California, in Los Angeles, they're at Catalina, but I'm going to see one today. And I would go for a hike and I would see an eagle. or an owl would come into my yard, or a falcon. It's just weird stuff.
It kind of makes sense. Like if you are peering, or somehow you've tuned into another dimension, or another way of experiencing a dimension beyond our three dimensions, or is it four? Space, time, whatever. That to us, if you were to be able to predict something in another room, or in a few seconds, or you were seeing things out of our typical, A, B, C, D, E, F, G format, the next dimension isn't supposed to be. It's hard to describe because you're describing something that doesn't exist in our realm. But
right, exactly.
So if time to us is linear and you can space time out and see it, you can kind of picture a long timeline. And now take that and put it into a fishbowl and mess it all up, but the fishbowl is right there in front of you. So every moment of that fishbowl you can see because the water's clear and it's all one. So there is no, we think of it as impossible to know what's going to happen in 10 seconds, but the next dimension, there's that probably has nothing to do with it. You know what I mean? That time and everything is all at once.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this teacher that I see, or this doctor, he'll tell me, he said, well, just ask Glenn. And sometimes I'll just ask a question and I get an answer like immediately. And then I think, oh, I'm just making this up. But then the stuff happens. I don't know. I mean, I'm a skeptic. I still am. But yet I can't deny that these things are happening. And sometimes I think, okay, well, maybe, okay, it's the moving the eyes back and forth, REM sleep. We have two separate spheres of our brains, the left and the right. So by moving my eyes back and forth, doing that, maybe I'm making my brain work together as one. Mm-hmm. And so the intuition is a side effect. I don't know.
That's a possibility too. And I think having that skepticism is a healthy way of looking at it, because it allows you to I guess explore all options and what it could be.
Right. Right. That's true. That's Rachel.
Sorry. I had a quick question. When you said you were asking questions and you would say it out loud, was it ever scary to you, or did you feel peaceful and it was calm? Were you afraid of the answers you might get, or was it?
Well, it was never scary. Well, actually, that's not true. What would happen, Kara, is that I would ask a question and I would get the immediate answer, and I wasn't quite sure what to do with that. It wasn't scary, but I kind of stopped doing that, and I stopped going to that doctor for about 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. And then I went back and I told him all this stuff, and of course he knew it because I would explain it to him. But then he did tell me that this Dr. Botkin, that this Dr. Carl Totten, who I was taught under, who he studied with, told him that, a side effect of that treatment is intuition or psychic ability. So it gave me a little bit of comfort. But yet, Kara, I have to be honest, though, there are many times when I go see him and I start getting these visions and seeing these things, that I immediately open my eyes and I said, okay, that's enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I completely change the subject and just want to talk about the weather. So I don't know if it's fear or it's just not allowing myself or the process to unfold naturally.
Okay.
Are you afraid?
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Oh, it does. I was just thinking, I think if it were me, I would be scared to know the answers, but I wasn't sure how you were feeling, but that makes
sense. Well, it's a little freaky.
Right, that's what I would think too.
It's a little freaky, and I really don't tell people. Mm-hmm.
But maybe reassuring at the same time, because you're seeing the positive things, and you're knowing that kind of that he's okay.
Yes, and every single time he tells me he's okay. And this is something else I wanted to tell you. When I see him, he's younger. Wow. He's younger and, like, I would say 20, 25 to 28. And of course, I didn't know him at that age. We met later in life, but I've seen pictures. But he's younger and healthy and like happy.
Wow.
Although there's also been times when I've gotten like a message from him that it's not all rainbows and unicorns, because I don't think it would be either if there is an afterlife.
Right.
I mean, people are people. I mean, I can't imagine that we all of a sudden, you know, leave these bodies and go floating on a cloud with a robe and a harp and ride on a unicorn.
That's true.
I don't know. But you know what it is, Kara? It's that losing my husband, and so suddenly I no longer fear death. So in many ways, I'm afraid of nothing now.
Right.
Whereas I think if this stuff would have happened before losing the love of my life, I probably would have been afraid. But now it's more wonderment.
Yeah.
Because the worst has happened. There's nothing for me to be afraid of. It will never get worse.
Does it affect your dreaming at all when you're in an unconscious state that you don't have control of?
Not so much. I mean, I've always had just crazy, wild, adventurous dreams. So not so much.
Okay.
That's continued. And I've only had 3 dreams of Glenn, which is interesting because I can do the eye movements and close my eyes and I see him like he's right in front of me.
You can do this.
But I've only...
Every time?
I could do it right now. Every single time. But but you know, the weird thing is I don't do it that much. You'd think you'd want to do that all the time.
Yeah. I want to learn how to do this. How would someone learn how to do this? Or is it possible to just learn?
Well, I would suggest going to Dr. Alan Botkin's website.
Okay.
He's in Chicago. It's easy enough to find. And then find a practitioner in your area. And it's worth spending the time and the money to just go and do it.
Do you mean insurance doesn't cover it?
Well, actually, it does, because you have to be a licensed, at minimum, a licensed family therapist.
Okay.
So it's not a new age crystal rubbing thing at all. It's based more in science, believe it or not. So I actually get reimbursed from my insurance company because I see an... He's a PhD. He's a teacher at a graduate school for psychology. You know, all kinds of letters behind his name.
Yeah.
But he does this treatment, and Dr. Botkin is not all woo woo.
Sure. How did he? And maybe you told me. I can't remember. How did he come up with this method?
Well, he was doing the EMDR treatments with his patients, which was invented by this Dr. Shapiro, which is meant for PTSD.
Okay.
But it was never having the death after death communications. Hmm. It's when he just was I guess, perfecting it or changing it up a little bit. And then one of his patients had the experience. And so then he tried it again and it happened again and again. And apparently in the clinical, in a hospital environment, it will happen instant after death communication will happen 98% of the time. And in an outpatient environment, which is what I had, 75% of the time. And another thing is, if I've been told and I've read that if you go there just to have that experience, it may not happen.
Hmm.
So I guess Dr. Botkin has even said that, like, he'll get emails and calls from all these new agers and he'll just tell them, no, I don't think so. Because it doesn't work when you're trying too hard.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's so simple. I just moved my eyes and closed them and I saw Glenn.
Hmm.
But then I started seeing, like, you know, my house before I moved to it. I mean, I recently moved and I saw it and I was describing it. So I don't, it's a little strange, but it is amazing too.
There's a, an organization out here called the Ryan Research Institute. And
yes.
Okay. So you're familiar with
them. I know of them.
Yeah. They're actually right down the road.
Oh, great.
One of the episodes last year, or maybe it was 2 years ago now, my neighbor and I drove out there and had our psychic abilities tested. And at that time, because when I started this program, I was the staunch skeptic. I was like, nope, that can't happen. And I went into this whole thing saying, nope, nope. And one of the experimenters were asking me to predict a card or something. I don't remember. And I kept getting them wrong. And then he said, you know, I know you're a skeptic and you're actually getting more wrong than you should theoretically get wrong by probability. So right now you're an outlier, meaning you somehow
you're doing it the opposite way.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You're absolutely, yeah, he said that I was yeah, basically doing the opposite of what I was supposed to be doing. And that alone is some sort of, they said, some sort of positive test to show.
Well, yeah, sure.
Yeah. So
because you were your brain was telling you to create the opposite.
Yeah.
It seems like.
And that, you know, I think approaching the subjects of the Rhine Center and approaching all this with an open mind is important, because if you woo-woo it or poo-poo it, whatever the word I'm looking
right,
for,
right.
Then, you know, you're either discounting a very real experience for someone, or you are closing off, you know, an area where that you could visit or that you could experience. The people who were at the center, when we went, there was about, I want to say, 24 of us, and maybe half a dozen were return people, or they go all the time and they do all the tests and all this stuff. They were very, very sure of everything that happened and everything that could happen. And as a skeptic, I look at it and I say, you know, they just, you know, they want to have this happen, or they think that this is happening. Perfect example is the spoon bending.
Right.
They're all bending spoons, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, you're just bending the spoon, but it's not your mind that's doing it. But who knows? If the experience is that real for the individual, then who's to say it isn't?
That's true. You know, or even if you put science into that and think of, like, you know, string theories and everything's connected. I don't know. Maybe if you think you want to move that spoon and then the molecules just, you know, are all connected and they move it. I don't know. But I also don't get into all the new agers either. I moved to Southern California in the late 1980s in the heart of the new age movement. And, mm-hmm. you know, those people, with all due respect, they'll believe anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like they'll say, oh, you see the mothership in the clouds? And they'll say, yeah, I see it. I'm like, no, it's just clouds.
There is some, yeah, there's some people that are out in the deep end, I guess.
Yeah.
I was, one of my guilty pleasures is I watch flat earth things on YouTube.
Oh, right.
For the soul, did your dog just laugh at me?
No.
I think I just heard, do you have a dog there?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Hannah. Yeah.
But I like to go on there because I like to see how these people are actually, you know, how they can possibly think this way.
Right.
It's fun, actually. It's fun to do that. But I mean, and I guess you have to draw a line, you know? You have to draw a line between logic and something that is rationally illogical.
Right.
Is that even, did I just do a, what's that called, Cara, when you do a oxymoron?
Oxymoron,
is something logically irrational?
Right.
But I mean,
that makes sense. I think a lot of things are.
Yeah. I mean, levitating while you're performing the lotus leaf position in yoga is logically impossible.
Yes.
But to close your eyes and have the experience that you had, I mean, I can't say that is logically impossible. I mean, it seems like the possibility is there.
I never would have believed it in a million years until I experienced it myself.
And now, from your bio and everything, I understand now, do you, I don't want to say counsel, but do you teach people about grief? Or?
Well, I do. And I've just started a foundation called Connections of Hope. My website will be up soon, and I'll be on Facebook soon. I am on Twitter, Connections Hope. And I just actually, I've been studying and preparing for this since Glenn died 4 years ago.
Okay.
And I just launched Twitter just two or three months ago, and it's exploding. People are reaching out to me from all over the world. And I'm writing a memoir. I do public talks about at least twice a month, either with the organ donation involvement, or there's a literary arts center in Venice, California called Beyond Baroque, where I take creative writing classes and I speak about grief and loss. And my goal really is just to help people know that there is hope and they're not alone. And I know what it's like.
And how do you approach grief counseling? Is it catered to the individual? I mean, if you go into, let's say I'm I'm Richard Dawkins and I lose my wife and I come to you, or I ask for some sort of help. Do you go into the metaphysical aspects, or do you also have the physical or I don't know what I'm the the concrete way of dealing with grief? Do you touch on that at all?
Well, both. You know, I found that, you know, believe it or not, you know, most grievers they have more similarities than not. You know, everyone feels the pressure to move on because society is so uncomfortable with their grief. Mm-hmm. All grievers miss their loved ones and just want them back. They have the feeling of being invisible, like a ghost that no one wants them to talk about their loved one. And then they want to have the connection, whether it's a dream or honoring them. I mean, you can be a hardcore atheist and still get comfort by honoring your loved one, doing a yearly anniversary, having a party for them, just even giving yourself permission to speak their name. My research has found, at least for me, has shown that there's two things that help with grief. One is time, and the other is having an ongoing relationship with your loved one who has passed. Whatever that means for you, I mean, that's going to be something different for the atheist or the Southern Baptist. But at the end of the day, people miss their loved ones and they just want them back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So giving yourself permission to honor them, to talk about them. I mean, we still talk about Martin Luther King. We talk about Abraham Lincoln. We don't say move on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yet if you were to talk about, you know, your dead spouse, you'll find that people become visibly uncomfortable. So I let people know it's okay to honor their loved one. And believe it or not, opposites work with grief. In other words, moving on, pushing the grief away, getting on with your life causes more grief. Hmm. Honoring your loved one, talking to them, having a dream about them, writing about them, whatever that is for the individual, helps with grief the most. There's no secret formula, but it seems to be those two combined.
Wow.
Really, really help.
And I think we tend to put it in the back of our brain, you know, and I think we started the conversation with this, that death is inevitable. Everyone's going to face it, whether it's a loved one, whether it's yourself, it's going to happen. And it's universal. I mean, it doesn't matter where you are, who you are, how much money you have, it's going to happen. And so I think it's important to prepare. I don't know, prepare yourself, because that almost sounds like you're walking around, you know, preparing for everyone you love to die.
Right.
But in a way, I guess you could, in the moments that you're spending now with them. I don't know. The more I talk about it, I hear myself say it, and you know it. I don't know if I've done that. You know, I don't know if I've ever prepared. Have you ever talked to, and I'm sure you have, but you talk to an elderly person, like my grandmother. She's in her mid 90s, and they talk about death like it's, you know, like it's Christmas next week. And maybe I use that, but like it's next Wednesday. You
right.
know, they say, well, I'll probably be dead by then or something like that. And when I would talk to my grandmother that is deceased for about 10 years, she would tell me how everyone she knew was gone, absolutely everyone, and that the next logical step was for her to go.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
I agree. I hear that from Glenn's mother. Mm-hmm. From Glenn's mother. This woman has had more tragedy than anyone I've ever known, and she's the most beautiful, beautiful human being that ever took a breath of life, next to my mother and Glenn, of course. She lost her husband 30 years ago, then her house burned down, then she had a brain aneurysm and survived, then her son died, then her grandson died.
Oh, that's awful.
And she's in a nursing home. But you know what? She still, like, she'll say, well, it's a good day, I woke up today. But she also will talk about, I'll be dead next week.
Yeah.
But she's not like a depressive. She says it almost like she's going to go to the grocery store.
Yeah, and that's what I found. Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess she's come to terms with it or something. I don't know.
That's a big thing. I think acceptance is a huge thing, because it doesn't matter who you are, if you're an atheist or a staunch religious person.
Right,
Once you accept it, it's really not a horrible thing. I've accepted death. You know, I've put my life on the line a number of times, and you know, I don't want to go early. I have a lot of stuff I want to do, but it doesn't haunt me. I focus on what I have to do here. But yeah. So, Rachel, I really want to thank you for, I mean, you shared a really, really personal story with us, and, grateful. Thank you. Cara had to back
me
up there.
It's my pleasure. I'm honored. I'm really honored. And, I just know that there are millions and millions and millions of people out there suffering with grief. It's like this whole underworld of society that I never knew existed. And I just want them to know that there's hope and they're not alone.
Sure.
I've been there. I understand. And there's more to this life than we know.
Yeah. And maybe on the metaphysical, end it with a little metaphysical, maybe somehow I was meant to see your Twitter and you were meant to go on my podcast, and there's someone listening now that you have reached, and they're gonna get some help.
You never know. I hope so. I'm in awe right now. I feel like I live in grace every single day. Wow. As crazy as that sounds.
And what is the name of your Facebook page again, so people can look it up?
Connections of Hope.
Okay. And
Twitter's just Connections Hope.
Okay. Okay.
And by the end of the summer, I'll have my website up and running. I didn't realize things would happen as quickly as they are. I've been invited to be on several other podcasts, Grief Dreams, Grammarica, Skeptico. So I'm kind of taking it one step at a time, and I just want to be very thoughtful in how I push this out to the public.
Sure. Well, it was very interesting. This is a good podcast. I think the listeners will enjoy it. And again, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kevin and Cara.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you both. Thank you.
You too. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast and at WWIPodcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.